making thin, parallel slices almost all the way through a potato, stuffing butter and cheese in between them, and roasting them until golden brown and crisp. What if I were to combine the two concepts into one glorious crispy, creamy, crunchy, cheesy casserole? The dish starts out just like most potato gratins. Sliced potatoes. If you've got an inexpensive Japanese mandolin slicer, then it's a snap. I tried it with both peeled and unpeeled potatoes, and preferred the cleaner crunch you get from peeled potatoes. From there, it progresses like a standard gratin. I mix heavy cream, grated cheese, I use Conte and Parmesan, fresh thyme leaves, salt, and pepper in a bowl. Then I add the potatoes and toss them all together. This step is worth taking your time with. It's crucial that every single potato slice gets coated on all sides with the mixture. That means prying or sliding apart all the slices of potato that are stuck together and dipping them into the fatty mixture. Here's where we turn things on their head. Rather than stacking sliced potatoes horizontally, like in a traditional gratin, I pack them into a greased casserole dish, standing on their edges, working my way around the perimeter of the dish and packing it all in tightly. Because potatoes will vary widely in shape, you end up with tons of little nubby bits sticking out all over the top surface. As the potatoes cook, the cream eventually starts to boil, simmering up and over the tops of the potatoes, basting them as they roast, aiding further in preventing them from getting leathery. A final layer of cheese added halfway through the uncovered stage of cooking adds a layer of flavor to the final casserole. During the final stages of cooking, the cream eventually loses enough moisture that it breaks, releasing its butterfat, which coats and then gets slowly absorbed into the potatoes as they continue to lose water content. Milk proteins in the cream and the cheese coagulate, creating little pockets of curd-like tenderness between slices. The final dish is nothing short of glorious. Look at it. I mean, look at it. Every bite has a combination of crisp but moist upper potato ridges and rich and creamy potatoes underneath, with a cheese underscoring the whole affair. It's so good that I've decided to make this only in the middle of the night while my wife is fast asleep and finish it all myself, picking at the crispy, cheesy bits around the edges of the casserole dish in the wee hours of the morning, leaving just enough to hint at the glory that it once contained. What, dear? What's the lingering aroma of garlic and thyme in the air, you ask? Ah, well, you snooze, you lose, hun. Mashed potatoes. Mashed potatoes are a particularly divisive topic in my family. See, I like mine rich and perfectly smooth, with plenty of butter and heavy cream, lots of black pepper, and maybe some chives if I'm dressing to impress. I usually am. Somewhere between a dish on its own and a sauce, the mash should have the consistency of a pudding, slowly working its way across a tilted plate. I like to pick up a piece of turkey and swirl it in my gravy-covered potatoes so that they coat it, their buttery richness working into the cracks in the meat. Sounds good, right? Who could possibly want it any other way? My sister, that's who. For Pico, yes, that's her real name, mashed potatoes should be fluffy and thick enough to stand up under their own weight, close encounters of the third kind style. The kind of mashed potatoes that can hold their own on the plate. The kind that you want to turn into a TV commercial with a pat of butter slowly melting on top. I'm talking smooth, but light and fluffy. So how do you arrive at such two different results with the same starting ingredients? It's all got to do with starch. The starch. For our purposes, potatoes can be thought of as basically three things. First, there are the cells, the little microscopic bubbles that all living things are made from. These cells are held together with pectin, a sort of natural plant glue, and the walls of the cells are where the starch is concentrated. The starch molecules, a type of carbohydrate, come bundled up in tight granules. As potatoes cook, the pectin breaks down, and individual cells expand and separate, releasing starch granules into the outside environment. These starch granules absorb water like little balloons, eventually popping and releasing sticky starch molecules. The concentration of released starch that makes its way into the final mashed potatoes, to a large degree, determines their consistency. To put it simply, for lighter, fluffier potatoes, the goal is to incorporate as little starch as possible in the final product. Potato type plays a huge role in this. Mealy russet potatoes have cells that readily fall apart from each other, meaning you don't have to cook them or work them too hard to get them to a relatively smooth consistency. Less working means fewer burst starch granules, which means fluffier mashed potatoes. Waxier Yukon Golds, or Red Bliss, require longer cooking, and they must be worked fairly hard to separate their cells, making for creamier mashed potatoes. The mashing method can drastically alter your end results. Carefully pressing the potatoes through a tammy, drum sieve, ricer, or food mill will separate the cells with minimal shearing action to break up the starch. Throw potatoes in a food processor, and an avalanche of starch gets released, turning your potatoes into the consistency of melted mozzarella cheese. There are some recipes, like the famously elastic pomme aligot, that require you to beat your potatoes into stretchy oblivion. Whipping the potatoes with an electric mixer will develop some starchiness, but still keep the potatoes creamy. Soaking and/or rinsing the potatoes can help you reduce the amount of starch that remains on them. Cutting potatoes into smaller pieces before cooking and rinsing them under cold water will wash away much of the excess starch. But there is a downside to soaking. It rinses away some of the enzymes necessary to properly break down pectin. Soak your potatoes for too long or cut them too small before soaking, and they'll never soften, no matter how long you boil them. So, just by knowing these factors, we should be able to determine the best way to get either style of mashed potatoes. Cream of the crop. Ultra-creamy mashed potatoes are really more of a French thing than an American one. And if you want to be fancy, you can call them pomme purée. The goal is to get them super rich, but not heavy or leaden. This requires some careful cooking to allow just enough starch to be released to give the potatoes the right texture, but not so much that they turn gluey. The best way I've found to do this is to boil medium starch potatoes, like Yukon Golds, just under tender enough to be pierced with a cake tester or paring knife with no resistance. Starting them in cold water helps them cook more evenly, as well as strengthening some of their pectin, which keeps them from totally falling apart in the water. I tried several methods for pureeing the potatoes, including pressing them through a tammy, lots of work, throwing them straight into a stand mixer, they never got smooth, and using the food processor, really, really bad idea. The best and easiest method is to just pass them through a ricer into the bowl of a stand mixer. You don't even need to peel them. After that, I whisk them on high speed with a paddle attachment, adding melted butter, heavy cream, salt, and pepper. If I'm not serving vegetarians, I also like to add a bit of chicken stock, which gives the puree an intensely savory quality. Don't give away the secret. On to the second variety. Fluff enough? Getting potatoes light and fluffy is a little bit trickier. One thing is clear. You want to start with mealy russets that will fall apart with minimal prodding and release starch in an easy-to-rinse-off manner. At first, I thought that simply rinsing away as much starch as possible before cooking would be the key. And, to test, I made 3 batches of potatoes. The first I cut into large chunks, the second into 1-inch dice, and the last I grated on the large holes of a box grater. I rinsed all 3 batches under cold water until the liquid ran clear. By collecting the drained milky liquid from each batch of potatoes and comparing it, it was easy to see that the grated potatoes released far more starch than either of the other types. Let's see how it translates down the line. Turns out that another weird phenomenon occurs when you try to cook grated and rinsed potatoes. They simply don't soften. I boiled the grated potatoes for a full 45 minutes to no avail. Even after forcing them through a ricer, pebbly, hard bits remained. What the heck was going on? It's got to do with that pesky pectin. When exposed to calcium ions, pectin cross-links, forming stronger bonds that are resistant even to prolonged cooking. As it happens, potato cells are full of calcium ions just waiting to burst out. By grating the taters, I ended up releasing so much calcium that the pectin got strengthened to a point where it never softened. The other two batches, the large chunks and the smaller dice, both formed a moderately fluffy mash. But to get the potatoes even fluffier, I found that rinsing the potatoes of excess starch both before and after cooking was the key. A quick pass through the ricer and a little bit of lubrication provided by some butter and whole milk gently stirred in with a rubber spatula, and my sister's potatoes were ready for sculpting. With both potato cooking methods in order, my sister and I can finally get back to fighting over really important things, like who gets to play the guitar part on Beatles Rock Band. 5. Balls, loaves, links, burgers, and the science of ground meat. Have you ever noticed that many times a group of things that seem pretty similar at first glance, upon close inspection, turns out to be nothing of the sort? I'm talking about things like Star Trek versus Star Wars fans. Star Trek is science fiction, Star Wars is fantasy, damn it. Computer geeks versus physics geeks. Hint, physics geeks wear shoes more often. And so it is with meatloaf, sausages, and hamburgers. I mean, all three are made of seasoned and cooked ground meat. How different can they be? Plenty different. We're going to discuss the travesty of sticking a small, patty-shaped meatloaf in a bun and calling it a hamburger. What you've got there is not a hamburger, it's a meatloaf sandwich. Just so we're all on the same page here, let's go through a few definitions. These are the three great pillars that support ground meat cuisine and lift it to magnificent heights. Don't worry if you don't quite understand everything yet. All will be revealed. A hamburger is a patty of pure ground beef with no salt, seasonings, flavorings, or additives of any kind mixed into it. It can be cooked any number of ways, but key to its production is that salt and pepper should go only on the exterior, and we'll see why later. Its texture should be loose, tender, and juicy. A sausage is ground meat to which enough salt has been added, about 1.5% of the weight of the meat, that the protein myosin has dissolved, allowing it to subsequently bind the meat together when the raw mixture is stirred. The mixture can be flavored with spices, vegetables, herbs, or any number of other additives, but the keys to its production are salt and meat. Its texture should be springy, snappy, and juicy. A meat loaf and meat balls are made of seasoned ground meat to which breadcrumbs, eggs, and/or dairy products have been added in order to discourage the cross-linking of meat proteins and produce a more tender finished product. As with sausages, an array of other flavorings can be added. Its texture should be tender and moist. So, how do you get three such different finished products from what amounts to basically the same set of ingredients? That's what we're going to explore in this chapter. The Food Lab's Guide to Grinding Your Own Meat. I'm a cook by trade, but a grinder by nature. Nothing pleases me more than the careful, controlled deconstruction and reconstruction of what nature has so carefully put together. Grinding your own meat at home is a uniquely satisfying experience. There's something profoundly beautiful to me about watching the chopped meat fall out of the grinder into the bowl, deep red, interspersed with discreet, creamy white bits of fat. I like the way it starts out free and pebbly as you pick it up, but comes together in your hands to form a burger patty. And I like how salt can make the grind sticky, ready to be beaten into a juicy sausage or a tender meatloaf. I've never met anyone who's decided to go back to using store-bought ground beef after having tried beef ground fresh at home. Once you grind, you never rewind. Why should you grind? 4 reasons. It's safer. Packaged ground beef can contain meat from hundreds, even thousands of animals, and not necessarily from the nicest bits either. This means that you've got to be extra careful when cooking with packaged ground meat. Chances of contamination are higher. Better flavor. Unless you've got a really great butcher, you're stuck with whatever ground beef the supermarket has on hand. Usually, this is no more specific than knowing the fat content. Even when it's labeled with cuts like chuck, round, or sirloin, there's no guarantee that you're not just getting scraps. Grinding at home allows you to control the flavor of your grind along with the fat content. Better texture. Pre-ground meat sits in the packaging, slowly being compressed and oxidizing. It's often ground much finer than is ideal for the perfect burger. Grinding it fresh lets you keep it nice and loose, improving both moisture level and texture after cooking. It's cool. Those who grind their own beef for their sausages and burgers get instant street cred in my book. You can't help but look badass. If you are still asking the question, why should I grind my own meat, instead of how do I grind my own meat, it's possible that you're simply hopeless. For the rest of you, listen on. Grinder, processor, or hand chopping? As a home cook, you have 5 different options for getting ground beef for your burgers: buying pre-ground beef from the store, having your butcher grind meat for you fresh, grinding at home with a dedicated meat grinder or stand mixer attachment, grinding at home in the food processor, or hand chopping with a knife. There are advantages and drawbacks to each method. Store-bought beef, for example, is easy, but, as I noted before, you have little control over flavor or texture. The food processor provides excellent results if you don't have a meat grinder, but it can take a little bit of planning. To find the best method for grinding beef, I gathered a couple of pounds of beef, ground using 5 methods. Store-bought 80% lean ground chuck, chuck ground fresh by the butcher, chuck ground in the meat grinder, chuck chopped in a food processor, and chuck finely chopped by hand. I tasted the results of each method cooked into 2 types of burgers, griddled and grilled, as well as made into sausages and meatballs. I analyzed all of the results based on texture, flavor, and ease of preparation. The results are located in the grinding method chart in the bonus PDF. Basic tips for grinding meat. There are a few keys to great ground meat that apply no matter what method you employ to grind it. Start with good meat. Just as you can't make a great sandwich on terrible bread, you can't make good ground meat out of poor meat. And, of course, you can't make a great burger or meatloaf out of poor ground meat. Start with whole cuts from a reputable butcher or supermarket, and select your cuts to optimize fat content and flavor. Keep everything cold. This is the single most important thing when it comes to grinding. Warm meat will smear, as opposed to chop, the fat will leak out, and it will result in a cooked texture similar to papier-mâché, pulpy and dry. Ugh! Place the grinder and all of its parts, or the food processor bowl and blade, in the freezer for at least 1 hour before grinding. I store my grinder in the freezer. Keep your meat well chilled right until ready to grind. If you are making sausage that will require several grinds, chill the meat in between grinds to ensure perfect texture. If using a food processor, freeze the meat for 15 minutes before attempting to grind. Watch for smearing. Keep an eye on the meat as it comes out of the grinder or flies around the food processor bowl. Ideally, it'll come out of each die hole in discrete little pieces. You should be able to clearly identify fat and meat. If it starts coming out as one mass, looks wet, and collects on the surface of the die, you are in trouble. Similarly, if it smears around the bowl of the food processor or chunks of fat ride along the blade, it's getting too warm. Remove the meat, rechill it, and try again. Keep your blades sharp. In a meat grinder, the blade is the only part of your grinder that should ever need much care or attention. A dull blade will smear meat. Luckily, the blade and plate should actually get better and better with repeated use. The metal grinds down microscopically each time you use it, so the contact between the blade and the plate gets tighter and tighter. Nothing grinds as smoothly as a well-taken care of, well-used grinder. You will occasionally need to get your blades resharpened if they've gotten way too dull. Once a year or so for a moderately well-used grinder is more than enough. Or simply buy a few replacement blades. They can usually be had for a few bucks. Similarly, if your food processor blade gets too dull, it should be replaced. If chopping by hand, always use a sharp, sharp cleaver. Keep everything clean. Part of the reason to grind your own meat is to make it safer. Working in a messy or unsanitary environment will throw all that out the window. Make sure to start with a clean cutting board when trimming your meat. Wash your hands and your knife carefully as you work. Avoid cross-contamination. And don't distract yourself with other tasks when grinding meat, no matter what method you use. If you use a grinder, allowing meat to dry and stick to the blade or inside the feed tube is a good way to get yourself sick. Remove and wash all parts of the grinder well between grinds. How to grind in a meat grinder. Here are the basic steps. Chill your grinder. Place all the parts in the freezer until thoroughly chilled. Trim your meat. Start with whole cuts and carefully trim them of any excess sinew. A certain amount of fat is okay, even desirable, but make sure your ratio of fat to lean is on point. I generally aim for around 20% fat to 80% lean, plus or minus 5 to 10 percentage points, depending on the application. Cut your meat into 1 to 2 inch cubes and chill them. Keeping everything ice cold will make sure that the fat stays firm and easily choppable. Grind from large to small die. If you need an extra fine grind for certain types of sausages, make sure to grind your meat twice, chilling it between batches. Once through a 1/4 inch die, then a second time through the smaller die. This will help prevent smearing and will give you a more even grind and a better textured sausage in the end. If it starts to smear, stop immediately. The meat should come out in clean, discreet pieces. If it starts to come out as a solid mass or extrude unevenly, you've got some sinews or other gunk stuck in the blade. Stop, remove the blade, clean it carefully, and start again. Use a paper towel to get the last bits of meat out. Once you're almost done with your batch of meat, you'll find that the last few cubes will have trouble getting through the die on their own. To push them through, crumple up a paper towel and feed it into the tube. It'll push the meat out, but will not get pushed through the grinder itself. As an added bonus, it'll clean your tube as it goes. How to grind in a food processor. Here are the basic steps. Chill your processor bowl and blade. Place the bowl and blade in the freezer for at least 15 minutes before grinding. Trim your meat. Start with whole cuts, carefully trimmed of any excess sinew. A certain amount of fat is okay, even desirable, but make sure your ratio of fat to lean is on point. I generally aim for around 20% fat to 80% lean, plus or minus 5 to 10 percentage points, depending on the application. Cut your meat into 1 to 2 inch cubes and partially freeze them. You want your meat to be as close to frozen as it can possibly be, without actually making it so hard that the processor will not be able to cut through it. I cut the meat into cubes, place them on a plate, and throw them in the freezer for about 15 minutes until they start to feel firm around the edges. Set up the processor and add some of the meat. Trying to grind too fast will cause some meat to ride around the blade, making for an uneven grind. Do not try and grind more than 1/2 pound, 225 grams of meat at a time in a 10 or 11 cup food processor. Pulse to chop. Don't let the processor run. Rather, pulse it in rapid bursts to allow the large chunks of meat to settle back down to the bottom of the bowl where the blade will cut into them. Pulse until you get your desired grind size. Generally 10 to 12 fast pulses will get you a reasonable grind for burgers, while 8 to 10 is what you want for chili and stews. Empty the bowl and repeat. Repeat until all the meat is ground. How to chop meat by hand. Here are the basic steps. Trim your meat. Start with whole cuts, carefully trimmed of any excess sinew. A certain amount of fat is okay, even desirable, but make sure your ratio of fat to lean is on point. I generally aim for around 20% fat to 80% lean, plus or minus 5 to 10 percentage points, depending on the application. Slice your meat thin. Use a sharp chef's knife or carving knife to slice the meat into thin, thin slices. Stack the slices, then cut them into thin strips. Finally, rotate the strips 90 degrees and cut them into small pieces. Use a cleaver. Once you have small pieces of meat, use a cleaver to reduce the pieces to the desired texture, using the weight of the cleaver to do most of the work for you. Sausage equals meat perfected. The story of the sausage is a humble one. Sausages were originally created as means to expand the useful portions of an animal. In the days before refrigeration, easy transportation, and canned dog food, when an animal was slaughtered, it was essential that none of it went to waste. People discovered that by chopping up the less desirable parts of the animal, adding salt to them, and stuffing them into various other bits of the animal, say the intestine or stomach, they could create a food that not only lasted longer than fresh meat, but also was in fact quite tasty in its own way. Thus, sausages were born. As with many other foods, like duck confit, fruit jams, or beef jerky, what was once a means of preservation, an act of necessity, is still practiced today because the end result is so freaking delicious. I mean, is there anything more humble yet so perfect as a well-made sausage? Evolution has done a pretty darn good job of producing delicious hunks of meat for us to enjoy. But with the sausage, we do Mother Nature one better. The right fat content, the right sodium content, proper seasoning, and perfect texture are built right in. How many pork chops can claim that? And to think that sausages are also one of the most inexpensive forms of meat on the market. Thing is, most people are familiar only with store-bought sausages, or, if they're lucky, those made by a good local butcher. And many of these can be quite good. Even some nationally available brands do decent work. But the real joy of sausages is their completely customizable nature. Who says that sweet and hot Italian are the only types worth eating, much as I love them? Once you understand the basic principles of sausage making and have a handle on the technique, there's no limit to your creativity. You like the flavor of juniper and cinnamon with venison? Go ahead and make a warm, spiced venison sausage. Broccoli rabe and cheese with chicken? No problem. Or how about just some garlic and parsley with pork? Yep, you can do that too. The craft of the cure. You remember that scene in the teen movie when the shy, nerdy girl in the glasses that none of the boys really wants to talk to gets a makeover, trades in the specs for contacts, throws on a dress, and is suddenly the hottest one at the prom? Well, that never happens in real life. But how's this for an awesome transformation? Turning the tough, sinewy back leg of a pig into silky, rich, sweet prosciutto, or the fatty, squishy belly into smoky, crisp strips of bacon. That is the craft of curing, and it's one of the pinnacles of cuisine. There's often confusion as to exactly what curing means when it comes to meat. Curing is the act of preserving meat or fish through the use of one of three methods: chemical cures, smoking, or dehydration fermentation. It is these three processes that are responsible for the incredible array of flavors you find in preserved meats from around the world. In France, it's called charcuterie. In Italy, it's salumi. Incidentally, salami is a specific type of salumi. Whatever you want to call it, it's the craft of preserving meat, of taking those bits that nobody really wanted to eat and turning them into the best-tasting stuff around. In this book, I've included recipes for the simplest form of curing, letting meat and salt mingle overnight, and you'll be amazed at the transformation that meat undergoes in even that short amount of time. But the world of curing goes far beyond the scope of these recipes. Here's a quick overview of what you'll find out there. Chemical cures involve the use of salt, sugar, nitrates, and/or nitrites. The idea is that by adding a high enough concentration of these chemicals, yep, salt and sugar are chemicals, you create an environment that is inhospitable to bacterial growth. Salt and sugar we know about. As for the other two, sodium nitrate and potassium nitrate, both break down into nitrites as a sausage ages. And these nitrites prevent the growth of certain types of bacteria, mainly the botulism-causing bacteria Clostridium botulinum. They play an important role in flavor development, as well as helping cured meats to retain a pink hue even after being cooked. Their effect on human health is debated, but it's probably a good idea to keep your intake of them to a reasonable level. None of the recipes in this book call for nitrates or nitrites, as none of the sausages are dry cured. These days, you may see bacon, salami, and other meats that have traditionally been cured with nitrates marked as uncured and nitrate-free, but it's a bit of a misnomer. They are still cured with salt and often with natural sources of nitrates like celery extract. Smoking meat with a wood fire also aids in its preservation. During combustion, nitrogen dioxide is formed and released from the smoldering wood. This gas reacts with the water on the surface of a piece of meat to form nitric acid. It's this acid that inhibits the growth of bacteria. Smoke also creates compounds that prevent the oxidation of fat. A smoked pork belly, aka bacon, will go rancid much more slowly than a fresh or simply chemically cured pork belly. Thinner pieces of smoked meat, like jerky or thin hot dogs, can become completely penetrated with nitric acid and other compounds formed in the smoking process, while in larger cuts of meat, say pastrami, these will only penetrate the outer 1/4 inch or so of meat. Incidentally, nitric acid prevents the breakdown of muscle pigments during cooking, which is what creates the bright pink smoke ring you see on a properly smoked brisket or rack of ribs. Dehydration fermentation is the oldest form of curing, and it's almost exclusively applied in conjunction with a chemical cure. Bacteria need water to survive, so fully or partially dehydrated meat will keep for far longer than fresh meat. Many sausages, such as Italian salami, soppressata, and French saucisson sec, are dried by hanging them in the open air, during which time friendly yeasts and bacteria partially break down the meat to create a whole host of wonderful, sweet, pungent, and funky flavors. European hams and American country hams lose a great deal of moisture through hanging as well. By slicing meat thin, you can increase its surface area, creating more places for internal moisture to escape. Beef jerky and Native American pemmican are made by drying thin strips of seasoned meat and fat. Some cured meats go through only one or two of these processes. Most fresh sausages go through a chemical cure with or without a smoking step. Lox is made by chemically curing salmon overnight. Cold smoke it, and you've got smoked salmon. Bacon is chemically cured and smoked, but minimally dried. Italian pancetta, cured pork belly, and guanciale, cured pork jowl, are cured with salt and nitrates, but not smoked and only minimally dried. Some products, like, say, Austrian Speck or All-American Slim Jims, go through all three processes, making them quite long-lasting indeed. If you want to experiment with your own smoking or dehydrating, or move beyond the basic sausage recipes in this book to more complicated emulsified sausages, think hot dogs, bologna, or mortadella, I'd suggest checking out Michael Ruhlman and Brian Polson's authoritative books on the subject, Charcuterie and Salumi. Sausage, meat, fat, and salt. Flavorings are all well and good, but there are really only three ingredients that are required to make sausage: meat, fat, and salt. Meat, by which I mean lean muscle mass, makes up the vast majority of a sausage, and the type you use is important. Remember the general rule that the more a muscle is used during the lifespan of an animal, the tougher but more flavorful it will become. So there's an inverse relation between flavor and tenderness. While relatively bland cuts like loin and tenderloin are prized for their tenderness as steaks, chops, or roasts, for sausage making, the tougher cuts are desirable. Grinding renders tenderness a moot point, so you might as well go for the most flavorful cuts you can get. Pork butt, shoulder, with its plentiful marbling and connective tissue, is superior to pork loin or tenderloin. Chicken thighs work better than chicken breasts. Beef short ribs or brisket makes better sausage than strip steak. All of this is good for us, because the ideal sausage cuts are the ones that happen to be the cheapest. Fat should not be feared. Every great sausage that's ever been made has been great in part because it is dripping in fat, at least 20% of it by weight. Fat adds juiciness and mouth-coating richness to a sausage. Fat is where most of the flavor in meat comes from. Try eating a bite of beefsteak cooked in lamb fat. You'll swear you were eating a lamb chop. Making a sausage without fat is like having brunch without cocktails. Where's the fun in that? If you're scared of fat, just eat less sausage. One bite of a properly fatty sausage is infinitely more enjoyable than any amount of a dry, low-fat version. Salt is by far the most important ingredient in sausage. A sausage simply cannot be made without the right amount of salt. The name itself comes from the Latin root for salt, sal, hence Spanish salchicha, or Italian salchicha. Without salt, a sausage will not bind properly. It will be mealy and mushy instead of snappy and springy. It will be dry and bland instead of juicy and flavorful. The most basic recipe for a sausage is as follows. Start with a mixture of 1 to 2 inch chunks of meat and fat in a 4 to 1 ratio. For extra juicy sausages, you can use up to 30% fat. Add 1 to 2% of the total weight of the meat in salt and allow the mixture to sit overnight in the fridge. The next day, grind the meat in a well-chilled meat grinder or food processor. Mix it together carefully with your hands or with a paddle attachment on the mixer. Pack into casings if desired, or shape and cook immediately. That's it. Simple, right? So how does the alchemy work? A sausage worth its salt. My mother and I are constantly at odds when it comes to food. I tend to like things saltier than the average person, while she can't abide even a pinch of salt. We usually end up compromising somewhere in the middle, but there's one food my mother will never get to enjoy in a low-salt variant. Sausage. As anyone who's ever tried to make a sausage without salt will tell you, it simply does not work. To prove this, I ground 2 batches of pork, both cut from the same shoulder. The first was seasoned with salt, weighed out at 2% of the total weight of the meat. You must use a scale when making sausage, and allowed to rest for 8 hours in the refrigerator. The latter was left completely unseasoned. I ground both of them in a meat grinder and formed them into balls. Even before cooking, there was a drastic difference in texture. While the salted meat stuck firmly to itself in a tight ball, the unsalted meat was messy, mushy even. I then poached them in 180 degree Fahrenheit water until they reached an internal temperature of 160 degrees Fahrenheit before cutting them in half. Check out what happened. While the salted sausage held together with a smooth, resilient texture, the unsalted sausage completely crumbled, in much the same way that an overcooked burger will do. I recorded the weight of each sausage before and after cooking. The sausage that was salted lost only 20% of the amount of moisture that the unsalted sausage lost during cooking. As we learned in the lesson on brining, salted meat is better at retaining moisture than unsalted meat. Flavor-wise, the difference was undeniable. The sausage salted overnight was vastly, unequivocally, night and day superior, with a juicy, snappy mouthfeel to its mealy, unsalted brother. Basic anatomy. Despite the fact that ground meat looks like, well, ground meat, it's actually got a fairly complex structure. In their whole form, muscle fibers resemble thick bundles of telephone cables, where each individual wire inside the bundle is a single juice-filled strand, known as a fibril, constructed of proteins. Chop up these cable bundles, as you do when you grind meat, and you end up with a whole bunch of shorter bundles. Shorter, but still intact. The protein strands are still held tightly within. When salt is applied to the meat, at first some of the juices contained within the muscle fibrils are drawn out through the process of osmosis. That's the tendency for a solution to travel across a permeable membrane in the direction of lower solute concentration to higher concentration. Translation: when there's a lot of salt outside of a meat cell and not much inside, water from within the cell will travel out to try and even out the concentration of solutes on the outside and inside. The salt then dissolves in these juices, creating a briny liquid. Certain meat proteins, namely myosin, will partially dissolve in the presence of this brine. Essentially, the bundles of telephone wires become looser, their ends fraying out. You can see this happening when you look at a chunk of salted meat sit. The exterior gets darker and darker as the proteins dissolve. This makes it far easier for the proteins to then cross-link when you knead the ground meat. Indeed, just by touching salted ground meat versus regular ground meat, you can instantly tell the difference. The salted meat is much stickier. It's this dissolved protein that subsequently cross-links with other proteins to cause a sausage to tighten up, giving it its springy, resilient texture. On top of this, with some of their proteins loosened up by the brine, the muscle fibers are able to hold on to much more moisture than before. In good time. What about timing? Does it matter how long you let your salted meat rest? To test this, I divided one pork shoulder into 8 different test batches. The first batch was left unsalted. The remainder were salted for intervals of time ranging from 24 hours all the way down to immediately before grinding. I then cooked all the different ground meats in vacuum-sealed bags in a 160-degree Fahrenheit water bath and weighed them after draining them. There's a pretty clear advantage to letting your meat rest before grinding and forming sausages. A wait of 2 hours saves you half of the juices that would otherwise be lost, while 4 hours saves you a full 75%. Not bad. Beyond 8 hours or so, the changes become incremental, shaving off a half percentage point or two before finally maxing out at around a 3.6% moisture loss level after a few days of salting. Fear the smear. A meat grinder is the best way to grind meat for sausage, though a food processor will do just fine, but it's not as simple as throwing chunks of salted meat into the hopper. Before you start grinding, you must remember the most important rule in sausage making. Everything must stay cold at all times. Why, you ask? The problem is with the fat. As fat gets warmer, it gets softer. Rather than cutting cleanly through the grinder, warm fat will smear, turning your fine grind into a mushy paste. Try cooking up this paste, and rather than staying in your sausage in nice, juicy little pockets like good fat should, the smeared fat will flow out of your meat in vast rivulets, leaving nothing behind but dry, mealy, lean meat. To prevent this from happening, it is vitally important that both the meat and the grinder be cold. If the meat for my sausage has not come straight out of the coldest part of my fridge, I spread it on a rimmed baking sheet and place it in the freezer for 15 minutes before attempting to grind it. Equally important is the proper mixing of fat, meat, and seasoning. Because well-ground meat is chopped, the tiny individual pieces of meat don't actually get much of a chance to rub up against one another and develop strong protein bonds through the dissolved myosin. So, after your meat is ground, it needs to be kneaded precisely like a ball of dough. The metaphor is especially apt. The purpose of kneading dough is to build up bonds between flour proteins to create better structure, while the purpose of blending sausage meat is to build up bonds between meat proteins to create better structure. And it also helps the flavorings to become more evenly distributed is an added bonus. The absolute easiest way to do this is in a stand mixer using the paddle attachment, though a large metal bowl and bare hands are much more fun. However you do it, just make sure to work quickly. You'll need to mix the sausage meat for at least a minute or two until it is sticky and tacky instead of loose or crumbly. But if it threatens to get too warm, throw it in the freezer for a few minutes to cool it off. You've come too far to ruin your sausage now. Flavoring. For the simplest sausages, all you need is pork shoulder and salt. But the beauty of a sausage is that, unlike a solid piece of meat, you can build your flavorings directly into it. And now that you know the keys to good texture and moisture, you are free to flavor your sausages however the heck you'd like. You can even make them with whatever meat you'd like, though here's a word of warning. Pork fat is the best fat to use for sausages, even when using other meats. Highly saturated fats like beef or lamb become waxy and will form an unpleasant coating inside your mouth as they cool. On the other end of the spectrum, chicken or duck fat is almost completely liquid at room temperature. Only pork fat is firm but not waxy at room temperature, and it has a relatively neutral flavor, making it the ideal fat for any number of sausages. Whenever I make, say, a nice lamb merguez, a North African sausage flavored with harissa, I'll combine my lamb with some pork back fat or even nice fatty bacon, making sure to adjust the salt level accordingly to account for the salt in the bacon. Same for my venison sausage, which I make from the organic proceeds of my annual hunting trip. I usually try to limit flavoring ingredients to about 2% of the total weight of the sausage, often far less. I've included a number of recipes in this chapter to get you started and to provide basic guidelines for some of the more popular seasonings. But really, your imagination and your palate are the only things restricting you in this realm. Experiment a bit and see what you can come up with. If you're afraid to inadvertently ruin an entire batch of sausage meat with overzealous seasoning, start by scaling down. Season just a tiny portion of your meat, then cook a small patty of it in a skillet or in the microwave. I usually just throw a quarter-sized patty on a microwave-safe plate and zap it for about 15 seconds until it's cooked through. This will allow you to taste and adjust the seasoning as necessary before any full-on commitment. To stuff or not to stuff? There's no two ways about it. Stuffing sausages is time-consuming. If I want to make a big batch of casing-stuffed sausage, I'll generally devote at least a couple hours of leisurely kitchen time to the task. And that's coming from someone who practiced stuffing sausages in a professional setting for many years. Complete amateurs can expect to mess up at least a few times, ending up with burst casings, unevenly shaped sausages, and meat-smeared clothes before getting it right. Most meat grinders and attachments come with funnels designed for stuffing sausages. They will work in a pinch, but can be a real headache to use. The main problem is that they don't push the meat through forcefully enough, so stuffing the sausages takes 5 or 10 times longer than it should. All the while, the meat is slowly warming up. I've had better luck stuffing sausage with a pastry bag. This requires 2 people, one to squeeze the bag, the other to pull the casing off the end as the meat comes out. But if you're really serious about sausage making, you'll want a piston-based stuffer that pushes the meat out with a lever rather than trying to force it out with a screw. The result is faster, tighter sausages with fewer air bubbles. Most good butchers will sell you hog or lamb casings packed in salt. To use them, rinse them inside and out with cold water and let them soak in a bowl of cold water for at least 30 minutes. Then open up one end of a casing and thread it over the end of the sausage stuffer, leaving about 6 inches hanging off the end. Slowly extrude the sausage meat, using one hand to guide the casing off the end of the stuffer. When stuffing sausages, you want the casing to be full but not too tight. Get it too tight, and your sausage will burst when you try and twist it off into links or when the casing shrinks during cooking. Once you've extruded the meat into the casing, tie off each end with a piece of butcher's twine or knot it, then twist it into individual links of whatever size you'd like. Tie a small piece of twine around each joint to keep the links tightly sealed. Don't want to bother with all this fuss? Don't worry, you don't have to. Casings are great because they create a natural cooking vessel for your sausage, as well as add plenty of texture and snap. But well-made sausage can do just fine on its own, formed into patties or logs. When shaping casingless sausage, keep a bowl of cold water nearby to moisten your hands. Wet hands make handling sausage much simpler. In the bonus PDF, you'll find a few recipes for basic sausage seasoning mixes. While most of the recipes in this book are American in origin, or at least seen through an American lens, I've included a few sausage recipes from around the world, because once you know how to make good sausage, it seems such a waste not to get a variety of simple recipes under your belt. After that, we'll talk about cooking them. If using casings, all sausages should be stuffed into hog casings unless otherwise noted. Use the metric system. You may notice that while many of the recipes in this book are written in standard U.S. measures, that is, cups, pounds, and ounces, you'll occasionally see me giving metric units, grams and liters. Why the inconsistency? While imperial units are the preferred unit in the United States and work perfectly well for recipes in which precision is not of utmost importance, say making a quick pan sauce or a batch of scrambled eggs, for certain recipes, generally baking and charcuterie, a little too much salt or a bit too much water can spell the difference between success and failure. It's at times like this that the metric system excels. Why? Several reasons. It's more precise. Right off the bat, your basic unit of weight in the metric system, the gram, is more precise than your basic unit of weight in the imperial system, the ounce. This means that measuring small amounts on a scale is more accurate. It's easier to work out percentages. Say you have a sausage recipe that calls for 1.5% salt by weight and 2 pounds of meat. I picked a nice round number to make it even easier. How much salt should you add? The math ain't easy, is it? Even when you do arrive at the right answer, 0.48 ounce. How are you supposed to measure a strange number like that? With a basic 10 metric system, figuring out percentages is essentially built in. Got 100 grams of meat? That's 1.5 grams of salt. 1,000 grams of meat? 15 grams of salt. 200 grams of meat? 3 grams of salt. See how easy that is? It makes scaling a snap. Sometimes you might feel like making a huge batch of bread dough or a small batch of sausage. With the imperial system and its 16 ounces to a pound, it's not easy to scale even a basic recipe up or down. With the metric system, all of your units can be scaled up and down with ease. Doubled, halved, tripled, no matter what, they consist of the base 10 math that we're used to working with. Experiment. Meat, salt, and time. So I've come out and said that good sausage can't be made without salt, and that the salt takes some time to work its magic. But you don't have to take my word for it. Prove it to yourself. Here's how. Materials: 1 pound boneless pork shoulder cut into 1-inch chunks. Kosher salt. Meat grinder or food processor, grinder parts or processor bowl well chilled. Procedure: divide your meat mixture into thirds and place each portion into a Ziploc plastic bag. Add 0.1 ounce kosher salt, about 1 teaspoon, to one bag, and toss until the salt is evenly distributed. Seal all 3 bags and refrigerate overnight. The next day, add 0.1 ounce salt to one of the unsalted bags and toss the meat to coat it evenly. Then immediately grind all 3 batches of meat, one after the other, and mix each one separately in a bowl. Weigh out 1 ounce of meat from each batch and form it into a small patty. Then fry all 3 side by side in a skillet. Weigh the patties after cooking and take note of their weight loss. Finally, taste, taking note of both texture and flavor. Results. Even before beginning cooking, you'll notice that the meat that was salted the night before is significantly stickier. This is the dissolved myosin cross-linking and creating a tighter protein matrix. Because salt also loosens muscle fibers and allows them to retain more moisture, you'll find that the batch that was salted overnight will retain between 10 to 20% more moisture than the one salted just before cooking or the unsalted one. When you taste the patties side by side, you'll see that the one that was salted overnight has a springy, juicy texture and is quite flavorful. The one salted just before grinding will also be flavorful, but will have a looser texture and have lost more juices as it cooked. Finally, the one with no salt will be bland and have a loose, mushy, or crumbly texture, more like hamburger than sausage. Not only does salt flavor meat, but in the case of sausage, it enhances its texture by dissolving muscle proteins, allowing them to cross-link and provide resilience and spring to the mix, as well as loosening muscle fibers to allow them to retain more moisture as they cook. Moral of the story, salt your sausage meat at least a night in advance. Cooking sausages. I'm sure you have been to at least a couple of those weekend warrior cookouts. You know, the kind where the host builds a gigantic fire made up of 75% lighter fluid in the grill, barely waits for it to die down, and then throws on a few bratwursts to cook, haphazardly flipping them to and fro with a big fork and keeping a lazy eye on them as he attends to the more important matter of cold beer. By the time the desiccated, blackened carcasses come off the grill, the only consolation is that the beer has, at the very least, deadened your senses to the point that you can manage to choke them down with plenty of mustard and ketchup to lubricate them. Okay, maybe a bit of an exaggeration, but people seem to be under the impression that a sausage is less delicate, less prone to overcooking than, say, a good steak. And this is true to a degree. Because it is cured with salt, a sausage essentially comes pre-brined. When cooked to a given temperature, it'll retain more moisture than unsalted meat cooked to the same temperature. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't treat it with care. How you cook your sausage depends on whether or not it's stuffed into a casing or formed by hand. Cooking sausage links indoors. Cooking sausages is just like cooking steaks or a whole turkey. The best way is to be gentle. You want to bring them slowly up to around 150 degrees Fahrenheit in the center. Indoors, it's possible to do this in a dry skillet with a lid over low heat or in the oven. But here's the most foolproof method to cook your sausages. Place your sausages in a pan or a pot full of cold water and place it over a medium-high burner. Allow the water to come up to a bare simmer, then turn off the heat. Let the sausages poach until they reach an internal temperature of 140 degrees to 150 degrees Fahrenheit. Of course, you don't have to cook your sausages in water. If you plan on serving them with a flavorful sauce or other accompaniment, say sauerkraut or a spicy tomato sauce, then you can simmer them directly in that liquid for better flavor exchange. Now, you could eat the sausage as is, and they'd be totally delicious. But usually you want to get some good browning on the exterior. If you're indoors, do this in a hot skillet with melted butter or oil. Add the hot cooked sausages and sauté them briefly, just until both sides are browned. You should be able to do this in just a few minutes, during which time the interior temperature of the sausage will rise to around 160 degrees Fahrenheit, resulting in sausages that are perfectly cooked both inside and out. Cooking sausage links on the grill. How does this method translate to the grill? There are a couple of options. The simplest is to build a two-zone indirect fire with all the coals placed under half of the grill, or half the burner shut off. Place the sausages on the cooler side of the grill, cover it, and cook until the sausages reach 140 degrees to 150 degrees Fahrenheit. Then transfer them over to the hotter side for some last-minute browning. An even better, but slightly more involved method, is to partially fill an aluminum foil pan with moist, flavorful ingredients, say sauerkraut and its liquid, or some sliced onions and apples, with a cup of beer, place the sausages in it, and set it on the hot side of the grill. As the contents come to a simmer and steam, the sausages will cook through gently. Once they reach 140 degrees to 150 degrees Fahrenheit, slide the pan over to the cooler side of the grill, sear the sausages directly over the coals, and then return them to the pan to stay warm until ready to serve. While grilling gently is far better than grilling hard and fast, the pan grill method is even better, with a moisture loss savings of about 50% compared to high heat grilling. Just as with any meat, it's important to allow sausages to rest after cooking in order to prevent juices from escaping when you cut them. If all went well, your grilled sausages will be juicy and moist from the edges to the center and fairly evenly cooked. with a reasonable amount of char on the outer surface and a faint pink smoke ring around the edges. Cooking free-form sausages. Free-form sausages are even easier to cook than links, though not quite as exciting. Because you can form them into thin patties or slender logs, cooking them evenly is not as difficult. A patty or a thin log can be cooked just like a hamburger, bearing in mind that you want it to come up to 160 degrees Fahrenheit in the center to avoid mushiness. Because sausages almost always have a high fat content, you must be careful to keep an eye out for flare-ups if cooking on a grill over direct heat. The easiest way to deal with a flare-up is to just move the sausages away until the flames die down. Covering the grill will also help reduce flare-ups by starving the coals of oxygen. For fat, log-shaped, free-form sausages, you can gently lower them into barely simmering water and poach until cooked through, then finish off in a hot skillet with butter or oil, or on the grill, just like an encased sausage. All-American Meatloaf. In his 1958 classic, 365 Ways to Cook Hamburger, at least it should have been a classic, along with hundreds of recipes for burgers, sauces, soups, meatballs, and casseroles, Doyne Nickerson offers no fewer than 70 recipes for meatloaf. 70! A different loaf every night for over 2 months. 10 loaves apiece for every man, woman, and child on the cast of Full House. Another classic. Amongst this litany are such colorful offerings as chili hot top meatloaf, it's flipped upside down and glazed with Heinz chili sauce, sunshine meatloaf, that'd be a loaf topped with ketchup-filled peach halves, and two, count 'em, two variations on banana meatloaf, one with green bananas mashed into the meat, the other topped with bacon and ripe banana. With such a varied and prolific precedent set, you may be disappointed to find out that I offer but a single lonely recipe for plain old all-American meatloaf, and not even one recipe that combines ground beef with bananas. But while Nickerson is unparalleled in his prolificacy, I plan on besting him in thoroughness. You see, Americans are proud of their meatloaf, and rightfully so. It's one of our national dishes, and deserves a place up on the pedestal, rubbing shoulders with the likes of hamburgers, barbecue, and hot dogs. I mean, it's a loaf made out of meat. What could be more decadent yet comforting than that? The very best meatloaf should be tender and moist, with a distinctly soft but never mushy texture. Velvety and rich should come to mind when tasting it, tender enough to slice with a fork, but firm enough to pick up that bite without it breaking. It should be a sponge for moisture, oozing juices when you eat it, but not leaving a puddle on your plate. It should be deeply rich and meaty in flavor and savory, with just a hint of vegetable undertones to complement and lighten the slice. But make no mistake, meatloaf is about the meat. And, of course, it needs to reheat well for sandwiches. We already know quite a bit about how ground meat behaves from our adventures with sausage, and we've learned the benefits of grinding your own meat, or at the very least, having it ground fresh at the butcher. From those starting blocks, arriving at perfect meatloaf is just a short skip and a jump away. Meaty matters. Let's start with the very basics. Anyone who's been to a supermarket has seen those plastic-wrapped trays labeled meatloaf mix, which contain a combination of pork, beef, and veal. Why the mix? What does each of these meats bring to the table? To find out, I made several identical meatloaves using a very simple mix of meat and a few sautéed vegetables, carrots, onions, celery. Each loaf was cooked in a vacuum-sealed plastic bag in a water bath set at precisely 145 degrees Fahrenheit. That way, I was certain that each batch was cooked identically. For my first test, I cooked 3 loaves, 100% beef, 100% pork, and 100% veal. After more tastings, including an exclusionary test, beef and pork alone, beef and veal alone, and pork and veal alone, and combining all three, a few things became obvious. Pure beef cooked in meatloaf form loses quite a bit of moisture and acquires a coarse, gritty texture and slightly livery flavor. Pork has a much milder flavor and more fattiness, with a less coarse, softer texture. Compared to beef and pork, veal loses very little moisture at all, and it has a tender, almost gelatinous texture when cooked. However, it's completely lacking in flavor. Why do three different meats cooked in the same manner return such different results? Well, pigs and cattle differ mostly in their fast-twitch versus slow-twitch muscles. Cows are large animals that spend most of their time walking around and grazing, requiring plenty of long, sustained effort from their muscles, which eventually turns them coarse and flavorful with a deep red color, a byproduct of the oxygenation necessary for them to perform work. Pigs are smaller and less active for sustained periods of time. You may see them trot over to the trough to gorge, but they spend the bulk of their time lying in the mud or in the shade to keep cool. Consequently, their dark, slow-twitch muscles are less developed. Instead, you'll find plenty of paler, more fine-textured, fast-twitch muscle, as well as a good deal of stored fat. As mentioned earlier, pork fat is also softer than beef fat, making it more pleasant to eat at normal serving temperatures. So, by combining beef and pork, you end up with a mix that has the great flavor of beef, but an improved texture and softer fat from the pork. Then what does veal bring to the mix? The difference between veal and beef is a little more subtle, having to do with the age of the animal. When a cow, or almost any mammal for that matter, is born, its muscles are not very well developed. Its fat is soft and malleable, its muscles pale and mild-flavored, with a high proportion of soluble collagen, the connective protein that transforms into gelatin as it cooks. It's the underdeveloped musculature that gives veal its tenderness, but it's the gelatin that lends ground veal its ability to retain moisture. How does this work? It helps to think of gelatin molecules as individual links in a very fine wire mesh, and individual molecules of water as tiny water balloons. As the collagen is converted to gelatin inside a meatloaf as it cooks, these molecules of gelatin gradually link up with each other, forming a net that traps water molecules, preventing them from escaping. It's this same quality of gelatin that allows you to turn several cups worth of water into a quivering jello mold with just a few tablespoons of powdered gelatin. Thus, the mix. Beef